This episode is brought to you by Visit Williamsburg. In Williamsburg, Virginia, there's never too much of a good thing. Whether you're a foodie, a golfer, a history buff, a shopaholic, an outdoor enthusiast, or a thrill seeker, you'll find what you came for here and more. So ask yourself, what is it you want? Discover Williamsburg and plan your trip at visitwilliamsburg.com.
Welcome to the New Books Network.
For the past two decades, Brad Warner's voice has been a constant in the North American Zen Buddhist scene. With nine books, starting at 2003's Hardcore Zen, up to 2022's The Other Side of Nothing, The Zen Ethics of Time, Space, and Being, Warner has contributed a lot to my own personal understanding of Zen practice, and also to the understandings of my students in my classes. In his latest book, The Other Side of Nothing, from New World Library, Warner untangles the concept of non-duality in clear language, while also digging deep into everything from his own years of moving back and forth between Ohio and Kenya to simply walking his dog around the block. The Other Side of Nothing, The Zen Ethics of Time, Space, and Being is out now from New World Library. Brad Warner is a Soto Zen priest, filmmaker, and author, and he is the president of the Dogen Sangha International. You can find Brad online at his website, hardcorezen.info. Please enjoy my conversation with Brad Warner. Brad Warner, thank you so much for joining me today.
Thank you for having me.
So, Brad, this is your third time chatting with me over the years. And just to kind of remind listeners who may not know you or your work a little bit, I'm wondering if you can just give a quick little intro to kind of who you are and what you do.
Oh my gosh, the quick intro. Yeah. I write books about Zen Buddhism. And I first got into Zen when I was in my late teens, and the bass player for a hardcore punk band called Zero Defects. And I felt that Zen at the time, my assessment of it was the most punk rock thing I'd ever come across, because the punk scene I was part of was that it was the kind of DC influenced by what was going on in Washington, DC, which was the straight edge thing, which was an idea of punks who didn't drink, didn't do drugs, didn't have meaningless sex, and had all these kind of ethical ideas and were trying to sort of change the world for the better, you know, as opposed to the, you know, punks who get drunk and roll around on the floors, although we had a few of those people too.
Yeah.
But I thought Zen was a way to take all of that to the furthest point it made sense to take it. And so I started doing Zazen and practicing. Zazen is a meditation practice. Eventually, I moved to Japan and I got a job working for a company called Tsuburaya Productions, who make a TV show called Ultraman, which if they're lucky, it'll something people will be hearing about soon, because they're making a big push to make it in America. Again, this is like the fourth time they've tried to make it big in America, but we'll see.
Gotcha.
But it was created by the guy who created Godzilla. So it's basically, it was the forerunner of Power Rangers. Ultraman came out, God, almost 10 years before the show that became the Japanese show that was transformed into Power Rangers later. So it's quite similar to Power Rangers, if you want to know what kind of a program we made. And at that time, I was also a student of this guy named Gudo Wafu Nishijima Roshi, who's a Zen teacher who translated a giant book called Shobo Genzo, which is one of the most famous classical pieces of Zen literature. And it's a huge body of work. And he ordained me he made me his Dharma heir. So that means I'm supposedly his equal in the, you know, I mean, you can, the tradition of the Dharma heir supposedly goes back to the Buddha. When the Buddha was old, he decided to make Mahakashapa his Dharma heir, and Mahakashapa was supposedly then the equal to Buddha. So supposedly I am the equal to Buddha. I don't believe that at all. But ceremonially speaking, that's what my teacher did for me. So that is the basis under which I wrote my first book, Hardcore Zen, which was successful enough that I've written nine more Zen books, or eight or nine, I'm not sure. Zen book, the latest of which is called The Other Side of Nothing.
How's that?
That's a version.
Yeah. Well, you know, last time you were here was episode 139 of Classical Ideas Podcast. And we did that in November 2019. And, you know, we ended that conversation and we were talking about music at the very end and the Misfits came up. And I remember thinking, holy smokes, we should have spent more time on that. And I'm wondering if before we get into the book, if you have been up to any musical projects the last couple of years. You know, the world has changed a lot since November 2019. And I'm wondering if you've been, you know, dabbling in music still since the last couple of years.
Well, I do. I've started this. I do a YouTube channel, which is at, if you go to youtube.com/hardcorezen, that's where you can find. And I do at least three videos a week. And I don't know when, a few months ago, I hit on the idea of doing my own musical introductions. And now the musical introductions have become more and more elaborate. So
yeah.
I spend actually a lot of time getting those together, probably as much time as I do working on the videos themselves these days. So I'm doing that. And I've gotten back into playing, which I had kind of slacked off on. And it's really great for me. Because I am enjoying it. And Zero Defects, that band I was in back in the 80s, is still formally together. We're hoping to do a gig in July, although right now we're kind of up in the air as to how that's going to work out. But we get together and play usually about once a year.
Awesome. How have you been enjoying making your YouTube channel the last couple of years? You seem to love it. I've watched so many of your videos, and I'm just curious about the process of having that digital creation as well as the writing. How are you enjoying making that YouTube channel?
Well, it's really great. And it's something that readers of my stuff urged me to do for a long time. I kept getting emails from people saying, you should do a YouTube channel. And I'd go, I don't want to do a YouTube channel. And then I think it was 2017 when I finally just decided, okay, I'll do it. I'd put up a handful of videos on YouTube before then, but I decided to see if, you know, what would happen if I did it on a regular basis, with the idea that I'd do it for a month or so, and then if it wasn't panning out, I'd just quit. And I really like it. It's a whole different way of relating to the audience, because I can kind of interact with people. I take questions, and you know, a lot of my videos are answers to questions that people send me. And just coming out there and talking is different. I found that a kind of funny thing happened when Hardcore Zen was the only book and the only relation, the only thing anybody knew about me was that book, because people would meet me after the book came out and go, oh wow, you're completely different from that book. And I'd be going, I don't feel like I'm completely different from that book. I think maybe the voice that people made up in their heads when they read my book was a different voice from the one I actually have. You know, they imagined I was going to be this angry shouting,
yeah,
I don't know, person, and I'm not that way at all. So this is a whole different way people can actually see me. And there's a different way you communicate when talking that's quite different from writing. And I realized this, I mean, I kind of knew this already, but one of the things I did with this book, The Other Side of Nothing, is, and don't ask me which chapter, because I can't remember now, but one of the chapters was I had made a YouTube video, and I thought that came out pretty good. YouTube has a transcript function on it. Most people don't seem to even know about this, but it'll generate a transcript of whatever you say. So I thought I would just generate a transcript of what I'd said in that YouTube video and make that a chapter in my book.
It's so good. And that's a great strategy. Well,
it sounds like a great strategy, but what I ended up doing, I did so much rewriting on that I decided I was never going to do that again.
Oh, gotcha.
Because I did as much rewriting of that as I would have done if I'd just written it without working from the transcript, probably more, because the mode of expression is so different, and what sounded good on a YouTube video when presented as a transcript that you read just was terrible. You know,
yeah.
And it was the same material. So I eventually figured out how to say the same thing in a different way, in a way that made sense in writing. But it's a different type of communication. And I think they're both valuable.
Yeah. And you've dabbled in podcasting as well. Do you like the video element more than the audio only?
Yeah, I do. I haven't figured out. I still have a podcast. And if you go to the Hardcore Zen podcast, there are... God, there's a lot of episodes up now. So if you haven't listened to it before, then there's plenty to listen to. But I haven't done a new episode for a while now. I think I did one about a month ago. And so, yeah, it's a different sort of a thing. And what I do doesn't lend itself to the sort of Joe Rogan thing where you have a guest on and talk to the guest about something. You know, I've just got to do it myself.
Yeah.
So sometimes I don't know what to say. And what I've been doing with most of the podcast is I record the talks that I give to audiences, and I've been editing those and putting those out as podcasts. And those work, I think, pretty well because I'm relating to an actual audience in front of me.
Yeah.
So that comes through. When I'm just talking into a microphone to no one, you know, in my living room, It feels a little weird, and I'm not sure exactly how to do it. And when I have the video, it somehow feels like there's somebody. Actually, now that I'm thinking about it, what I'm seeing when I make a video is I'm seeing myself on the screen, you know, because that's the way it works.
Yeah.
And so I'm relating to that guy.
I love that. That kind of reminds me of the dog walking chapter in the new book. Cause it's like, who is that guy? I love that you kind of can assess your own like body language and, you know, and use that as sort of a way to make sure, do I like look like I'm an engaging presence for the viewers of this, you know?
Yeah.
So let's talk about Other Side of Nothing. It's your ninth book by my count, and
you're
eighth.
Probably right. Yeah.
Yeah. And I think it's your eighth for the current publisher, New World Library, who I've been working with for a long time. And, you know, the world is so different compared to the last time you and I were on the phone here together. And I'm wondering how the idea and focus for this book took shape over time, because the context of people's lives has been so strange the last few years that I'm just wondering what was going on in your thought process as you were putting this book together.
Well, one of the things I decided to do kind of early on in the writing was I wasn't going to reference any of the stuff that happened in 2020 and 2021. There was a version of the book where I had a couple of references to that in it, and I took them out because I just thought, this isn't going to, you know, this is going to be one of those things that ages the book. And also, I think there are issues that transcend all of that. Mm-hmm. You know, the things certainly did change. But I mean, the thing I've learned by studying Buddhism, which is a 2,500-year-old philosophy, is that a lot of things change, but there's some things that don't change, mm-hmm. you know. And if I can relate to Dogen's writings from 800 years ago, in which he does not reference any of the many, many struggles and bizarre natural disasters and such, like all the things that were going on in Japan 800 years ago, which are arguably even more of anything you can imagine than what we went through in the last couple of years. I mean, Japan was in a state in the 1200s. And if you read Japanese history, you go, oh my gosh, how did Dogen refrain from mentioning any of this? But he was trying to talk about something that transcended all of that. And I thought that was a good thing to do. You know, part of the impetus of writing the book, though, was a feeling that there was a kind of a crisis of ethics, that people were looking for ethics, that people wanted to find the right way to live an ethical life, but instead of finding the right way to live an ethical life, they were finding slogans and movements to join and things like that, where you know, a powerful person comes along and tells you this is the right thing to do, and everybody goes yay and follows that thing without actually looking at the fact that the person who's telling you this probably doesn't have any better idea than you do about what's right and what's wrong. And we've got to find that ourselves. And to me, the Buddhist ethical system was all about how to find the right way to live for yourself and by yourself. And that was the major theme of the book. But I realized pretty quickly in writing it that the underpinning of the Buddhist ethical system is an understanding that the world is not at all what we think it is. And we ourselves are not at all what we think we are, and that there is this kind of transcendent unity of all things. And this is, you know, everybody says this. You hear millions of people out there going, everything is one, we're all together. Mm-hmm. But I think it quickly descends into cliche. And I want to try in that book to get into what does that really mean?
Gotcha. You know?
Yeah.
Well, you know what? This is, by my count as well, this is like 20 years now that you've been writing about Zen, Dogen, and practice. And,
it's,
you know,
pretty close. Yeah. Hardcore Zen came out in 2003, but then again, I would have been writing it a few years, maybe as much as 5 years before then. I was probably working on it. So, yeah.
What keeps this fresh for you? Like, how do you maintain such an immense interest in the topic to keep this commitment to writing going? Because, you know, you come out with a new book with such regularity that, like, I feel like this intense intrinsic motivation for you, like, this is something that, like, you have to do at this point. And I'm just wondering what keeps it so fresh for you.
Yeah, it's sort of a compulsion, I suppose. I want to do it, and I feel like there's something to say. And the more, I mean, it sounds maybe pretentious, but I think as I get better at doing it, I find ways to kind of just channel something. It's not like channeling. I mean, in the business I'm in, people are sort of expecting things like channeling and whatnot. So it's an unfortunate choice of words I just made there. It's not literally channeling something in the sense of like disembodied spirits speaking through me or anything like that. But I think there are ideas that want to be expressed that kind of transcend the people who express them. Mm-hmm. And what I try to do is get out of the way and let that happen. And I do a lot of lectures and things, and I've found that is possible with the right sort of audience. Things can kind of come through. Things that I don't expect to even say start getting said by me. And then I go look at it afterwards and go, really? You know?
Yeah.
Some of it surprises me to hear, even as it's coming out of my mouth. So I feel like there's something else out there operating. And I mean, musicians do this too. And a lot of people do this. I think even athletes do it to a certain extent. And people who do things in those public forums can sometimes learn to get out of the way and express something that's a sort of a collective thing that wants to be told.
Yeah.
That the individual is not even part of.
Well, you
I
know,
mean, the individual is obviously part of it, but yeah.
And I feel kind of like that as well. Like I'm compelled to continue recording conversations like this. This is my fifth year of making this show. And it's a compulsion at this point, just like you said. And I kind of see my role in doing something like this as to get people on here that, you know, write interesting books and then let them tell some stories and then just put it out into the world. And like, that's kind of the way that I see a show like this, you know, does that make sense?
Yeah. I think it really does. It's just, it's something that needs to happen. And it's weird to me because I look at my, I kind of came from a, Well, my whole upbringing is kind of is something I wrote about. I've written about in a lot of books, but I think I wrote in more detail in this book than I have in any others, and it's sort of weird. But my family is, although we lived in Africa and I lived in Japan, my family is basically from Northeast Ohio, or from Ohio in general. And there's a kind of mentality over there about what work is. And work is going to the factory or to the office and making your contribution to society. So I've always got this nagging feeling in me because of that, going, well, I'm not doing real work because I'm just sitting in front of a microphone talking, or sitting in front of a computer typing. You know, I'm not, that's not real work. Real
right.
work is the lugs on the tires, or, you know, the whatever you do in Akron for your real work. But I think that this kind of work really is necessary, and it really is important in ways that I think a society as a whole sometimes doesn't know how to value. Either they overvalue it in the sense of, you know, movie stars and people making ridiculous amounts of money, you know, where it gets super overvalued and placed on these sort of special people who become kind of almost like modern day royalty or modern day gods almost, you know, or they totally undervalue it, and you've got the struggling poet who can't even feed himself, you know.
Yeah.
So, but there's got to be a middle ground. I've probably got the middle ground in the sense that I, you know, make a modest income from doing this and haven't become terribly famous. But I think it's necessary work.
Yeah. Well, you know, you mentioned your childhood as well, and that is one of my favorite things about this book, is that it contains long reflections on your life throughout living in Africa to Kenya and then back again to Ohio. It's from Ohio to Kenya and then back to Ohio. And I'd love to know about the role of reflecting on your youth and how that came to be such a vivid part of the storytelling within this book.
Well, it sort of came about in a funny way, in that New World Library just got the rights to a bunch of Alan Watts's books. And this happened during the time that I was writing The Other Side of Nothing. So I asked Kim, my publicist at New World Library, if she could get me some copies. And one of the books they sent me was called In My Own Way, which is Alan Watts's autobiography. Mm-hmm. And I actually didn't finish the book. I started it, but I was really enchanted by these detailed descriptions that he gave of his childhood. And I thought, well, let me see if I can come up with something like that. And I don't know if I'll use it, but I just sat down and started to type it. And what came out was kind of, I thought was kind of interesting. But I was just trying to do what Alan Watts had did in his book and describe it as vividly as possible in terms where people could actually sort of picture what it was like. And I could picture what it was like myself. And I think it's interesting because I said the traditional thing. Okay, let me say it this way. The traditional thing in Zen is to leave yourself out of it. And like Dogen, my great literary Zen hero, it's difficult to construct, even though he wrote, you know, I haven't even gone through all the stuff he wrote. He must have been writing constantly because he died when he was 53 or 54, depending on how you reckon his age at the time. And yet he produced even more literature than I have, and I'm older than he was when he died, and started later in life than he did. So but he never says much about himself. You know, he has all this opportunity, and you get little bits and pieces there, but he's not interested in his personal story. And that's kind of the tradition in Zen, is to just not talk about that because it's not important. Everybody's got their story, you know. It's like everybody's got a bum hole.
Yeah.
Know? It's like, you know, and nobody cares about them except you, you know.
Yeah.
So
yeah.
That's the attitude in Zen. But I also thought, well, maybe it is valuable because it does this. These truths might be universal, but they're expressed by individuals. And even Dogen, he can't help himself but to be who he was, which he was raised as an aristocrat, you know, and left that life to become a Zen monk. But the aristocratic upbringing he had comes through in his writing in a really, you know, in a big way. That he even, there's even a little passage where he apologizes for it in one of his writings, you know, how flowery his language is, because he just can't help himself. That's how he was raised to speak. And that's how he wrote, which is one of the reasons his writing can be so difficult. It's very difficult to translate properly, because it's just this super flowery Japanese aristocratic language that there really is no way to translate because we don't have those words in English.
Yeah.
Literally, we don't have a lot of the words that he used, don't have even equivalents in English. So yeah, it does come from somewhere. And I thought writing about where mine comes from might be useful to the audience, because I think there is a tendency, if you don't put that in, for people to sort of imagine that it comes from, you know, some kind of a guru on high sitting on top of a mountain, you know, in robes and pontificating about the nature of the universe. And if you know it comes from a guy who could ride his bike from one end of town to the other in 10 minutes, I put that in the book, you know, about the town that I grew up in when we weren't living in Africa, the Ohio town. You know, it's something that people can go, oh, okay, it comes from there. Maybe this stuff isn't inaccessible to me. And I was glad to have teachers. My first teacher was another guy from Ohio, and seeing that he had practiced this ancient Eastern highfalutin philosophy and practice was kind of inspirational to me to go, okay, well, if Tim could do it, you know, I think there's hope for me to do this.
Yeah, gotcha. Well, you know, in the book, in the introduction, you also have some reflections on how the world is in what you call a sorry state, which I think about constantly as a parent and as a person who, you know, fights personal cynicism a little bit of the time in my own life. Yeah. And, you know, the world has changed a lot in the last 20 years since you've been writing. And being a publicly facing thinker, I feel like comes with a series of challenges, because people from the outside world tend to put what they see onto you, possibly, especially as our communication moves from being, you know, very face-to-face to much more digital and virtual and instantaneous. And I'm wondering if, and you kind of allude to that in the book, and I'm wondering if there's been any sort of hard experiences about your writing career that have exacerbated as the world has gotten far more digital and fast-paced.
Well, yeah, it's weird, isn't it? You know, because I was at least in my late 20s when the internet became real. You know, I mean, there was sort of an internet, I guess, even before then, but only nerds were using it. I had a nerdy friend who was on the internet in the 80s, so I was kind of exposed to it early on by seeing him. But I thought, oh, it's just these really geeky guys who use this thing, and then it becomes a thing for everybody. And yeah, it's changed a lot. As far as hard experiences, it's kind of, I had to stop looking at the Amazon reviews. At first, it was sort of exciting to look at reviews on Amazon of my books, because they're ordinary people reviewing it rather than professionals who were paid to review it and probably got the book for free. It's interesting to see things that are written by people who actually bought the book, you know, with their own money, and who aren't professionals at reviewing. They kind of have a whole different perspective. But I did this book called Zen Wrapped in Karma, Dipped in Chocolate a few years ago. And that book, that's where I stopped reading reviews, because that book made certain people angry. And a lot of the reviews that came up on Amazon were just, they weren't about the book. And in fact, some of them were claiming that there were things in the book that weren't in there, you know, and then getting angry about these things, you know, saying, Brad said this and that and this, and this is why I hate it. I'm going, well, I didn't say that. That's not in the book. You know, that isn't in the book. So you just made that up yourself. And I don't know if it's done out of malice or what, but there was like three or four of those reviews. And I just was like, I'm not going to read these things anymore. And I haven't read an Amazon review of one of my books since then.
Nice.
Yes. And, you know, just the fact that people can communicate so easily gives people, I remember, it was Thomas Dish, a science fiction author who I liked. And when internet first became a thing, I sent him an email. I sent an email to the address that was the email address that I got for Thomas Dish, expecting that it was, I don't know, some manager or something was going to look at that. And I got a reply from Thomas Dish himself, you know, and I was like, whoa, Thomas Dish wrote to me.
Yeah.
And that was in the 90s sometime. And now this is just kind of an everyday occurrence. So one of the things that happens to me is, and it hasn't happened that often, but every once in a while, somebody gets confused, you know, and they think they know me because they see me on their video screen and they've heard my voice and they've probably, you know, in their heads responded to it. And then I get kind of weird interactions with people who are,
I understand that too, for sure.
who have some kind of a bizarre notion that I'm their friend. And I don't know anything about these people, but they come at me as if I know as much about them as they know about me.
Yeah.
You know, and it can get very strange.
Yeah. Well, let's, you know, the Other Side of Nothing has an interesting subtitle, including the word, and I was thinking like, ooh, this is very Carl Sagan, where you mentioned time and space. And I'm wondering if you can talk to me about what the importance of time and space is within this book in relation to the subtitle of the whole book itself.
Well, one of the weirder aspects of Buddhist philosophy is that time and space are an illusion. And that's a difficult one because we are so steeped in the idea that time and space are real things that to hear that that's an illusion is sort of like, what do you mean time and space are an illusion? The only thing I'm sure that exists is time and space.
Yeah.
You know, you can come at it that way. So I wanted to talk about that. And I did a few chapters on Dogen's philosophies regarding time and space. And it's quite interesting because it points to an idea that this world is not what we think it is. So we kind of have an image of what we think reality is. And it's based on our perceptions, our sensory perceptions, and whatever cognitive ability we have to put those sensory perceptions together. Mm-hmm. And human beings are really skilled at doing this. And it's probably the reason we exist at all. I think as animals on the African savanna, when we were just, you know, one of the many species of animals running around on the plains out there, the only defense mechanism that human beings really had against, you know, saber-toothed tigers and whatever else was a danger to us was that we could outthink them. You know, apparently we could outrun them to a certain extent too. I just learned that recently. But I think outthinking the other animals was the key to our survival. So we just put all our collective stuff into getting better and better at outthinking other animals. And now we're incredibly good at outthinking other animals. And our senses are fairly keen. You know, now that we can measure it against other animals. We seem to have, you know, my dog can smell things that I can't smell and hear things that I can't hear, but his vision isn't quite as good, and his tactile senses are certainly not as good. You know, so we got a lot going for us in those areas, and we assume that the information we're getting from our senses and our ability to integrate that sensory information are a true reflection of what's actually real. And the Buddhists have been for the last few thousand years questioning that and saying, well, no, we don't think so. And it's kind of an interesting thing to watch a contemporary science kind of catching up to that, you know, because science was founded originally on the idea that our perceptions were correct, you know, and then we're going to work it out. And it's worked. You know, you and I are communicating on computers, you know,
yeah.
And people listening out there are probably listening on these little devices that are amazing pieces of technology based on human sensory perception and the ability to manipulate that. And so it's hard to disagree with it. So whereas I think the Buddhists are right in not trying to challenge science. There's a lot of religions who go out there and say, well, no, science is wrong. Our holy book is right. Download it on Kindle, you know, and yeah, the fact that you can download your holy book on Kindle kind of says a lot about science, you know. It doesn't, you know, that maybe science does have something on the ball, you know, that maybe there is something. So
yeah.
It's not that the Buddhists would challenge science and say that it's wrong. It's that they'll say, yes, it's right, but it works in a limited area, and we are generally blind to how limited of an area science works in. You know, because we sort of assume it's universal, it's everything, you know, but yeah. It isn't. It actually works in a limited area of sensory perception, and sensory perception might not be right, and our cognitive ability might not be up to actually understanding reality. And that's the other thing in the Zen tradition. Is a lot of the Zen tradition is sort of famous for making these statements that on the surface don't make any sense at all.
Yeah.
You know, that's kind of one of the things Zen is known for. And one of the reasons for that is to just point out that, yeah, everything is limited. The most eloquent thing you can say about reality still doesn't get it. And so, you know, maybe just say something really simple and short that's also true, and let that just kind of hang in the air and see if it sparks anything. I think that's what the Zen tradition is often trying to do with these, you know, weird cryptic statements and, you know, things like Zen master pounding his fist, you know, the famous sort of cliche Zen guy coming up to a lectern, you know, hitting it with a stick and then leaving the stage, you know, and that being the lecture. One of the reasons for that, it sounds irrational and weird, but if you actually get into the tradition, the reason for that sort of behavior is often to just say, here's reality, bang, you know, anything I can say about it isn't gonna explain it any better than this noise I'm making by pounding my fist on the lectern. You know, that's. But now that once you explain a joke, you ruin it. So that's kind of.
Well, you know, and something else I was captivated by in this book is your descriptions of non-duality, because as a high school teacher myself, I'm always looking for ways to explain challenging concepts to teenagers. And I think that your book does that really, really well. And I'm wondering, like, if you were standing in front of my students, my teenage students who do not practice Zen, who are learning about it for the first time, how you might explain something like the importance of non-duality to them, which you do so well in the book.
God, I don't know how I would do that. I've actually had a couple occasions where I've been invited to, it's only happened maybe two, maybe three times where I've been invited to high schools to give.
You should do it. If you ever get the chance, you should do it.
Yeah. I did it. There's a video, actually. I put it up as part of my YouTube channel a couple of years ago, where I'm talking to a vocational high school in Ohio. And what was interesting is, you know, it's a vocational school. So these kids aren't even planning to go to, they've already decided at 15 or 16 years old that they're not going to go to university. They're just going to, you know, learn a skill and get a job. So you'd kind of, I didn't expect them to be stupid, but I didn't expect them to be sort of deep thinkers about things. And I was surprised it was one of the best audiences I ever had. And I got some of the deepest questions from these vocational high school students. You know, and I thought, well, okay, this is really good, but it's difficult to explain. And I probably in a high school setting do exactly what I do for anybody else. Is what I try to do is I'll prepare a few things to say that I hope will be a little challenging and maybe even a little confusing for the audience. And my strategy is to get the audience to ask me about those things. And I'll even sometimes start off a lecture by telling people that this is what I'm going to do. and it doesn't always work. It doesn't always stimulate questions. But when it does, that's when it works. My teacher gave me, when you become ordained as a Buddhist, your teacher will give you what's called a Dharma name. And the Dharma name always has some meaning, it's supposed to traditionally sound a little bit like your actual name. And the Dharma name I got was Odo, which doesn't really sound, it sounds vaguely like Warner if you really stretch your imagination. But Odo means the way of responding. So it's like, so something my teacher must have picked up on was that I do better when answering a question. So that's what I try to do. I try to get people to ask me a question, because then if I get a question, then I can focus in on that aspect of the thing that the person asking the question is most interested in. Because I think there's probably as many ways to explain non-duality or anything really as there are people who want to know about it. And you know, part of what the Zen literature does is it just says the same thing over and over. That's kind of the big joke about Dogen. He wrote so much stuff, but really he just says the same thing again and again and again. But he's trying to say it in different ways, because that's actually significant. It's important to try to say it in different ways, even though you're just saying the same damn thing over and over. So that's what I do. I just say the same thing over and over and hope that somebody picks up on it.
I love it. Well, you know, one of my favorite chapters in the book is Who Walked My Dog? Because it struck with me because of the recurrence of the question, who am I in Zen practice, which is something that I love to talk about in my high school classes, like who am I over and over until the kids basically throw their hands up in exasperation. And they're like, man, I don't know. It cracks me up every time, because I do it to them every single year. And I loved how the simplicity in the chapter of like walking the dog is not so simple at all. I just thought this chapter was so fun. Like thoughts occur to us, even though we do not seek to conjure them in our minds. And it's almost like we're happening, like these thoughts are happening against our will. I'm wondering if you can reflect on this chapter for me, because I just really love this one in particular.
Well, I'm glad you liked that one, because that was the one it comes late in the book, but I feel like it's the sort of center of the book, even though it's kind of placed off center in the sequence of the chapters, in that it comes like almost pretty near the end, I think. But yeah, it was literally, I thought of that because as I was writing, we'd just gotten this dog, Ziggy, who's still with us. And I had to walk him. That was my main break from writing. I would write the book and then walk the dog and then write some more book and then walk the dog again. You know, that was my life for months working on this book. And it struck me that this was an interesting way to think about it. Like, who is walking the dog? you know, we make so many assumptions. I've made so many assumptions about who I am. You know, I had assumed for years that I created my own thoughts. But once I got into Zen practice and started looking at it, I realized I don't create these. I mean, to a certain extent, I can seem to make them flow in a certain direction sometimes, but most of the time they just kind of happen. And one of the weird things that happened to me in my Zen practice, it was one of the things you do is you stop relating so much to your own thoughts if you do this practice long enough. And once you do that, I think for most of us, the thoughts kind of get very wild for a time, and you start becoming aware, at least I started becoming aware of thoughts that didn't fit me at all. They didn't seem to come out of my personality. They just seemed to come out of nowhere. And like, what the hell was that? You know? Yeah. And going, well, if that can kind of come up in my head unbidden, well, I don't know what's going on. I don't know who's in control here.
Right.
You know, I've got a certain ability to it, but it's very limited. And just asking, like, who walked my dog? Did my body walk my dog? Did my mind, did my past walk my dog?
Yeah.
You know, there's all these kind of questions that arose when thinking about that. And I was actually doing what it is written in the chapter. I was actually walking the dog and thinking, oh, okay, well, who's doing this now? You know, it's such a simple activity. You know, I just take him around the block on his leash and he pees and poops.
Yeah.
You know, and that's, but it's, I mean, that's what Zen is all about. It's about looking at the most simple activities. That's why our meditation system is so non-systematic. It's basically just sitting still. I mean, that's what Shikantaza is, the technical term for it, but it's a style of meditation in which you just try to get into just sitting. Like, I'm just going to sit. And that's I include myself in this when I say that's a struggle. If you actually try to just sit without doing anything else, you know, all you're trying to do is hold this posture and stay still. And you're not trying to use that as a method to have an experience or to become a better person or to try to do anything. You're just trying to sit still for the pure activity of sitting still. And I do it every day. And every time I sit down and do it, it's a struggle to do it, you know? Mm-hmm. Because it's like those kind of things that you read about in like different Asian systems of calligraphy. Like the traditional way some calligraphy teachers do this is the character for one in Chinese characters, which the Japanese also use, is just a horizontal line. That's the character, you know, that's how you write the number one. We write it as a vertical line, they write it as a horizontal line. It's basically the same thing.
Yeah.
But they'll have you do that. Some calligraphy teachers will have students do that for years. Just write the number one, you know, over and over and over until they can get into the purity of just going whoop, you know, and then they're allowed to write the more complicated characters. Whereas we think, oh, you know, that's a waste of time. Maybe this is a relation to the punk rock thing too, because you know, you're playing uncomplicated music, but trying to do it with fierce dedication, which, you know, I have respect. I have tremendous respect for people who can play complicated music. One of my favorite bands in the world is King Crimson, and they're known for their, you know, incredibly ridiculously complicated stuff. Sometimes that rivals even, you know, classical music and jazz for complexity. And I love that stuff. But, you know, you also, there's a way of doing something that's only got three chords and you try to play them exactly right. That can be a challenge too. And that's more of the Zen type of challenge is to try to play those three chords, but do nothing else, you know?
Yeah. Well, Brad, I loved earlier that you said that you feel like you're still getting better at what it is that you do, because, you know, I've been reading your books for a long time, and this one is really enjoyable, and I have absolutely loved hearing about it in the process of it. And I'm wondering if you have any like updates on your teaching or speaking plans, or what's next for you writing wise.
It's hard to say what's next for me writing wise. I haven't gotten started on a follow-up to this book yet, but that's kind of normal for me. I usually spend a few months not deliberately writing another book. I'm going to Europe. I've gone to Europe every year, with one notable exception that everybody knows, since 2009. I went last year too, and I'm going in September, and I'll be speaking in Germany, England, Finland, possibly the Netherlands, France. So that's really interesting to me to do. And like I said, I've done it every year. Because my first book got published, the first language it was translated to was Finnish, and they invited me, some people, and set up a tour for me of Finland. And I thought, well, if I'm going to Finland, I can go to some of these other places in Europe too. And I started doing it as a regular thing. So that's always interesting. And the YouTube channel, which you mentioned before, that's an ongoing thing that I really enjoy doing. So I actually look forward to making my YouTube videos every day, and I typically don't do them on Mondays and Fridays, and I kind of miss it, but I also feel like if there's too much, it's no good either. So that's why I take 2 days off a week. So I'm going to keep doing that, and yeah, we'll see where it goes from there. I just moved. I moved out of Los Angeles, where I've been living for, God, I don't know, almost 10 years, really. And now I'm in a smaller city in California. And one of my things is I want to see if a Zen group would even work here, because it's totally different from Los Angeles, you know. I haven't started yet, but we'll see where that goes.
Nice. Where would you like to draw listeners' attention if you want to, you know, send them to check out your work?
Well, the YouTube channel, which I keep mentioning, is youtube.com/hardcorezen. Or if you look up Brad Warner or Hardcore Zen, you'll find me pretty easily if you forget, you know, how to find it. That I update 3 times a week. And there's a blog, which I haven't updated as much, which I used to do several days a week, but I haven't done it that often lately. But that's hardcorezen.info. And that's, I also have links there to everything else that I do, to the books, to my live appearances, to the YouTube channel. All that stuff is linked through hardcorezen.info.
Excellent. Well, Brad Warner, author of The Other Side of Nothing, The Zen Ethics of Time, Space, and Being, as well as many other books like, Hardcore Zen, Don't Be a Jerk, Letters to a Dead Friend About Zen, It Came from Beyond Zen. There's so many, and they're wonderful. So I encourage anybody out there to check all of those out. And Brad, thank you so much for coming back. And I look forward to having you back on for your fourth appearance someday. I really appreciate your time and your years of engaging with this show at this point. It really means a lot.
Well, thank you for having me. I appreciate it.